NASA nixes DEI, and updates on Mars sample return. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. In an agency-wide memo, NASA announced it is closing all its diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility offices and ending DEIA-related contracts. The move comes in response to an executive order signed by President Trump his first week in office. We'll speak with Keith Cowing, editor of NASAWatch.com, about the measure and the implications it has for the agency and its tens of thousands of employees and contractors. Then, NASA's exploring options for how to fly a Martian sample back to Earth. The agency is looking at two ways to carry out this mission over concerns over cost and time. We'll speak with UF's Amy Williams about the future sample return mission and current missions on Mars with the Martian rovers. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA has long celebrated the diversity of its workforce and put measures in place aimed at getting more underrepresented people involved in the agency's mission. That includes diversity programs in the STEAM field, science, technology, engineering, art, and math. But those efforts have come to an end, according to a memo sent by acting NASA Administrator Janet Petro. She writes, quote, "The programs divided Americans by race, wasted taxpayer dollars, and resulted in shameful discrimination," end quote. The memo is tied to a wider Trump administration effort to remove DEIA initiatives from all federal agencies. Keith Cowing is the editor of NASAWatch.com, an independent watchdog organization that keeps close tabs on the agency, its leadership, and personnel. He's also a former NASA employee. He joins us now to talk about the widespread impact he believes this policy will have on the agency and its tens of thousands of employees, both civil servants and contractors. Keith, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Well, Keith, let's start with the memo itself that was sent out to all of NASA's employees. What did it say?
Well, it was a formulaic sort of boilerplate memo that the Trump administration sent to all government agencies. And it pretty much said, this is the email you should send out. So that's what they sent out. And for some reason, Janet Petro put her name at the bottom. She didn't need to, but that sort of dialed up the anguish that a lot of people felt when they saw it. It was pretty stark. It didn't give any wiggle room. It says, this is going to happen. If you catch people being diverse, you could turn them in, that sort of thing. And that's what had people spooked.
Yeah, the line of the memo reads, there will be no adverse consequences for timely reporting this information. However, failure to report this information within 10 days may result in adverse consequences, which is kind of looming there. You mentioned that it was signed by Janet Petro, who previously was the Kennedy Space Center director. She's the acting administrator now. Do these comments, you say they're boilerplate comments, but by her signing her name on there, does that kind of jive with what her previous comments or commitments to DEI efforts in the past have been?
I don't believe it does in any way, shape, or form. If you'll recall, just the day before that, we weren't even sure who the acting NASA administrator was. Normally, it would be the highest ranking career, which would have been Jim Free. But then I went to the White House. I don't know if I broke the story, but we all discovered it all at once. The White House said, no, Janet Petro is the acting NASA administrator. I'm told from multiple sources she had no idea. Jim had no idea. Nobody at NASA had any idea. And so she was suddenly administrator with like no warning, probably had to get in an airplane. And they said, here, sign this. So she did what she normally would, and that's put her name on it. Subsequent to this, she sent things out that say embrace the challenge and things that are more like her. But she wasn't really given an option. And if she said, I'm not going to send it out, she wouldn't be acting a NASA administrator.
Let's talk about any of the potential fallout from this. Have we started to see changes at NASA already? Are we seeing positions eliminated or positions not being posted anymore?
Well, it's interesting. Just yesterday, I'm just sort of experimenting with this, the pervasiveness of this anti-diversity thing. I found a page on the NASA website that talked about the NASA astronaut selection back in 1978. And it said very explicitly in there it was the first time that women and minorities were chosen. And prior to this, astronauts had all been white males. So I put that up and said, hey, let's see how long it takes NASA to... Well, they deleted it in less than 24 hours. Deleted it. And some of the people in that picture were memorialized for having died in the service of NASA just the day before. And so I have another one up. So you say, well, so what, Keith? I said, well, what a coincidence that some news blog can highlight things that someone somewhere just nukes. And it's history. It's the history of NASA. And it's gone because it used the word diversity and talked about non-white males. And so you put that in one part of this discussion. The second is I have had people tell me that they have been working in diversity-related things either directly in their title or on projects that had funding for that. And they said, Keith, we've been told to not come to work. We don't know if we're going to have a job. Changing our title won't do anything about this. And if you read another memo from the Trump administration, they say, you need to identify who these people are. They're going to stay home. And then you're going to look at how to get rid of them from the agency. And oh, by the way, anybody who's not worked at NASA for more than 2 years, you can get rid of them because there's no really viable complaint process. So it's already started. They're going after this subset of things. But memos have come up from the science mission director who said that we have gone through all our procurements and all our programs, and we've had to scrub DEIA, DEI, diversity, inclusion, whatever, from what we've asked people to do. And there will be more. And this is just it's been a week. Mm-hmm. And this is already happening.
Keith, you know, a large part of the NASA workforce isn't just the civil servants that work for the agency itself, but also federal contractors and companies that have these partnerships with NASA. Does this memo, this DEI initiative extend to those contract workers? And you know, what implications could this have for the agency as a whole?
Well, if you read the memos, it just says all these activities and they don't really care where it's done. And already contractors have said, yeah, this actually was a memo sent out to all the contractors and grantees from NASA on education and outreach saying you've got to stop doing this and identify the programs just in case we missed some. In other words, make a list of the things we're going to stop doing. As far as contractors go, having been both a civil servant and a contractor, I'm here to tell you that, you know, with a civil servant, you have a process to get rid of people. With contractors, you just say, oh, we're not doing that anymore. And they're gone. And so if you look at the way that the NASA workforce is, it's sort of a pyramid where you have 50, 60,000 civil servants, but then you have maybe 10 times that many contractors. And if I were a contractor right now, I would be seriously looking at job hunting. If you are in a field that is related to that or a mission that includes that, and there's more to come. I mean, they've just started on this anti-diversity witch hunt.
I know there's more to come here, but I want to talk about some of these lasting impacts that it could have. I mean, this NASA historically has been an agency committed to diversity. We recall, you know, it highlights its next moon crew as carrying the first woman and person of color on Artemis II. Does language and programs like that change with a memo like this from the Trump administration?
Well, it could. And it's interesting because during the Trump 1.0 administration, they added the first woman into the tagline that they used at NASA. And then when the Biden folks came in, they added first person of color and international partner. Now, I've highlighted that one of those pages as well, saying this is overtly dripping with diversity. And oh, by the way, this is logo of a person of color looking up to the stars. It's all on NASA's website. So I've said, hey, you know, are you going to let this stand or are you going to take this down too? And so it would be interesting to see if they tell NASA to change that wording and if they remove the person of color and international partner and leave the first woman, or if they just take that out too. My guess is they're just going to scrub all that out eventually. Hmm. And why? You got to ask them. This is a priority for them. They've referred to diversity, which you correctly state has been part of NASA as long as I have known it. And they've encouraged, you know, more and more people from more and more places, underserved communities, non-traditional. They've gotten artists involved as well as poets, as well as scientists and engineers. And there's always been a focus on the youth and the next generation. All of that seems to be evaporating. I mean, what's going to happen with the HBCUs? I think the word diversity is probably in every other paragraph of how NASA describes and funds that program. And if you look at how they're going to lay people off, if they do a RIF, which is a reduction in force, it's a formalistic way that you look at how to downsize by having different employees compete for the same job and you keep one and get rid of the other. Well, you're going to have people putting your backgrounds up. And if they say that your diverse nature of who you are, however you were hired, is no longer relevant, you'll find that the people with less experience are more likely to not meet the requirements as compared to somebody with more experience. And who are those people with the less experience? It's the very people hired from diverse communities, women, minorities, and so forth. So it's going to have a double whammy when that all starts to hit. So this is a gift that keeps on taking.
Mm-hmm. HBCUs historically black colleges and universities, as you mentioned, which have had a long legacy with engineering and sciences, right? I mean, that could be a huge pipeline that gets closed, right?
Well, yeah. Former NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden spoke of a lot of things fondly, including the Tuskegee Airmen. Mm-hmm. Well, I just saw something in Air Force Times where they had a page about the value of the Tuskegee Airmen and how that worked forward through time, and they had to take that article down off of a government military website. So this isn't just NASA. I focus on one agency, but this is pervasive. These memos went out all across the federal government, and it's just started. We haven't seen the full extent of this.
You mentioned that NASA for a long time has encouraged diversity in STEM, also STEAM. You mentioned the arts program, and that's because the STEAM sector has historically struggled with diversity. With NASA taking this step, are we going to see wider effects on the STEAM and STEM industries as a whole?
Well, again, yes. If you just look at, first of all, STEM or STEAM or education or whatever has been a punching bag for the past several administrations where they take the money out, they put it back. They call it the NASA STEM Development Office because they didn't want to call it education under Trump. And Congress told them, call it this weird name. And they've kept that because it's they really mean education, but they say STEM Development Office. So right away, you're getting into semantics. So if you don't want to call something what it is, even if it is what it is. But again, if you look at what they're trying to do, they're trying to get underserved communities, non-traditional communities, people with disability. And, again, every other paragraph probably has underserved, diverse communities, women, whatever, pick your word, as part of the broader reason that STEM is being sought as a way to embrace the full diversity of everybody in the country who, by the way, pays all the taxes for all the shiny spacecraft.
Finally, Keith, doing away with DEI is one thing, but I want to talk a bit about culture. Some people might say DEI initiatives are programs, but what really matters is the culture inside of an organization, especially one as large as NASA, and how welcoming and inclusive it is. How does this change the culture of NASA in the long run?
Well, it's interesting. I'll be 70 in a few months, and I grew up watching Star Trek on a black and white television. And one of the very first notions of space exploration, which, by the way, I'd already been following for years since I was like 6 years old, was that there in the future on a spaceship, there were women and black people and Asian people and all working together. Now, this may sound totally Trekkie, and yes, I am one, but it stayed with me. And a lot of the folks that are still running NASA grew up with that ethos and what followed. And, it may sound like we're a bunch of nerds. Well, maybe we are. But that has always been the sort of the ideal of NASA, that everybody should be able to work in NASA. Everybody should be interested in understanding what the agency does for them, and everybody should get to go. And that's where the agency's been heading. And now you have this sledgehammer of anti-diversity falling upon not just NASA, but the entire government. I don't know. I mean, all the organizations that support NASA, I'm about to repost something. Not a single one of them has said anything about this. And yet they'll go on and on about how diversity is great and so forth. There's a fear component to this as well. Don't speak up. Just let this happen. It's too bad. We'll get over it in 4 years. And unfortunately, I think within 4 years, you ask, how is this going to affect NASA? The damage will be done.
That was Keith Cowing, the editor of NASAWatch.com, an independent watchdog organization that keeps tabs on the agency, its leadership, and personnel. He is also a former NASA employee. Still to come, bringing a piece of another planet to our planet, NASA's trying to bring a slice of Mars to Earth.
Some of the things that they'd floated was leveraging commercial assets and commercial contracts in order to enable bringing the samples back.
Updates from our rover friends on the Red Planet and NASA's plans for the Mars sample return mission. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. As the International Space Station starts to age, the plan is to retire it in 2030. But what will replace the ISS? Instead of one giant station, commercial companies plan to have their own individual stations, and Axiom Space is one step closer to launching their commercial platform. Hear more about Axiom's future space station. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, Rovers have been exploring the Martian surface for years, exploring craters and ancient rocks. And as part of the Perseverance rover's mission, scientists hope to bring samples from Mars back to Earth. But because this mission would be costly and would take years to complete, NASA's now evaluating other methods to get a piece of Mars back to our own planet. Here to talk more about the sample return mission and updates from Perseverance and Curiosity is Amy Williams, a member of the rover's science teams and an astrobiologist at the University of Florida. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Brennan.
So let's take an update on what you've been working on when it comes to these rovers. I understand that there's had to be a pause in exploration. Why is that?
It's good to remember that, you know, we have our rovers up on Mars and doing all this great exploration, but really what keeps things running is the humans on Earth. And a lot of those humans have been impacted by the fires in the LA area. So the Jet Propulsion Lab is where most of our engineers and many of our scientists on these missions, you know, they work at JPL, which is in the LA Basin. Because of the impacts, you know, people have died. People have lost their homes. I have so many colleagues who are displaced. And so we actually stood down rover operations for maybe about 2 weeks or so.
And when it comes to a vehicle like Perseverance or Curiosity, they are built where they don't need human interaction every day, right? So that gives your colleagues time to recover and rebuild if necessary, and they will wait for your commands. Is that right?
Yeah, the rovers will go into run out and kind of wait for us. And eventually, if they really don't hear from us, you know, they might go into safe mode. So just kind of a low power waiting for us to talk to them again. Neither of our rovers had that situation this time. We were able to communicate to them to just, you know, hold tight until we can get back to you. And so they've come back online beautifully. And it's just a real testament to, I have to say, the perseverance of the humans who operate these missions to come back and to get these missions operational again.
It's a great reminder, Amy, that there are people behind it and those people are recovering from those fires. So thank you for that update. Now that the rovers are firing back up and the scientists are back on deck, where is Percy?
Percy is still, you know, outside of the Jezero crater at this point. We are exploring sort of this outside Jezero component of our mission. And so that means that we've climbed up and out of the crater, really high up on the crater rim. So if you picture, like, if you have a big impact, you know, an asteroid, a bolide of some kind that hits Mars and it makes this big crater, it actually raises the rims of the crater up relative, of course, to the surrounding landscape and the bottom of the crater. And so that's what we spent a lot of time climbing up and over. And so we kind of got to this point where we were at sort of the top of the crater rim looking down outside of Jezero, which is really incredible to see this landscape. Because again, it's, you know, using the term alien seems a little heavy-handed on this show, but it's a truly alien landscape. And, you know, one of the reasons we're so interested in exploring this is you're getting into what we call basement rocks, which are sort of the foundational igneous rocks that make up a lot of Mars's surface. And they are ancient, what we call Noachian. So it's a sort of a time frame way back in the 3.8 billion year old mark, which we really have very, very few rocks of that age on Earth. And so we now have the opportunity to examine these crazy ancient rocks outside of Jezero crater. We've been exploring a place that we named Witch Hazel Hill, which is this really cool kind of layered terrain that you see from orbit. And so we've done a few abrasions on some of these rocks, trying to understand what kind of rocks they are. Are we looking at an impactite, which is rocks that sort of fuse together after an impact? Are you looking at basement igneous rock? Are you looking at something that got so hot that maybe it metamorphosed a little bit from the impact? This is such cool stuff. And every one of these rocks is just so unique and nothing that we've really explored before. So we are truly in terra incognita. We are exploring something brand new on Mars with Perseverance every day.
Truly rocks, huh? Truly rocks, doesn't it?
Yes, truly rocks.
Yeah. Hey, I want to go back to something you said because it was pretty fascinating. The rocks you're looking at, you said, are 3.8 billion years old?
So that's our best guess. Right now, we don't have ages for anything, but we have sort of these names that go with sort of broad timescales, Noachian, Hesperian, Amazonian. I mean, we're talking about a billion year error bar on some of these. I mean, these are huge time frames we're talking about. But we know that we are in some of the most ancient terrain that Mars has to offer out here outside of Jezero Crater.
For comparison, what are some of the oldest rocks here on Earth? And follow up, what can you learn by comparing these different rocks from different planets?
A lot of the rocks on Earth have been recycled due to plate tectonics. So the oldest rocks on Earth are preserved in places we call cratons. So these are sort of just the last residual bits of basically continents that have been trying to float around since continents, you know, really formed and stuck around on Earth's surface. So 3.5 to, you know, 3.8, that is probably the age range you can see for these cratons for the most part. And it's just pretty small. You know, if you think about how big Earth is, it's a pretty small kind of volume compared to the rest of Earth, where you have a couple of these cratons around the world. They're in Canada, in Australia, in South Africa. And so, you know, we only have these little windows into these rocks, and they're not pristine, I would say. So have been impacted for the most part by plate tectonics, in that the original rocks, which might have been sedimentary rocks, so pieces of rocks come together to form a new rock, these have actually been metamorphosed a little bit. They've really been impacted by being around on Earth for that long. Whereas on Mars, without plate tectonics, you don't have that kind of processing. So much of the surface is ancient. So we know, what can you learn from this? What we're able to do is basically see what Earth was like 3.8 billion years ago as an analog in these Mars rocks. You get to see sort of the geochemistry. You get to understand how the rocks may have been laid down, laid out. And, you know, if there was life, how might it have interacted with the landscape? So, yeah, it's a way to kind of see the infancy of a planet, kind of almost time travel, going back in time to see this, because it's all paused on Mars, whereas on Earth, we've lost much of that record.
Fascinating stuff. So you mentioned right now Percy is up in this crater rim. It's looking down into the crater. Are you getting images back from Percy? And if so, does that kind of help you plan out where the rover may go next?
So as far as where Percy is going, we've had plans since, gosh, before we even landed. So we've actually had these locations identified for years now based on orbital data, images, spectroscopy, so you can kind of understand what maybe the rocks are made of. But yes, when it comes to actually navigating, you do need those images. So we got to this really great point where you're sort of at the pinnacle, the highest point between Jezero Crater, and you can look back down into Jezero, but you can also look forward outside the crater and sort of out into that ancient Noachian terrain. And so got these amazing images of sort of looking back and looking forward. So it's really cool to kind of look back in the crater. And if you really basically digitally stretch the images so that you can bring out really subtle details, you can kind of see some of the features that we drove past at this point years ago now. But the atmosphere is so dusty that you do have to do a lot of digital stretching in order to see these things. So unfortunately, it's less like looking out from, I would say, like the mountains in the west. And it's more like kind of looking across the Blue Ridge, where it's all just a little bit kind of dusty and fuzzy.
Still very pretty, I assume, so.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Amy, it's great to know that the team is back in business and getting things going, and to hear about where Percy is up in the crater rim. I want to zoom out a little bit more and talk a little bit about some movement on probably the most exciting aspect of these missions, and that's the Mars sample return and getting these samples back. NASA released some new information on how it may go about doing that. Can you bring us up to speed on the plan so far as to get these rocks back to Earth?
The plan has, of course, been in flux as we've had to adjust to so many changes in how to accomplish Mars sample return. So recently, NASA administrator came out, you know, describing sort of how we might proceed and be able to accomplish Mars sample return. So one of the issues was that the price was a little bit difficult to swallow, and the timeline is also challenging. So not getting rocks back until, you know, 2040 is not the time frame that any of us had hoped for. And so NASA did all of this work to ask for alternative architectures. You know, how can we bring the rocks back more quickly, and how can we do it at a more reasonable price tag? And so, you know, some of the things that they had floated was leveraging commercial assets and commercial contracts in order to enable bringing the samples back. And they're also looking at leveraging existing hardware. So this is something in the NASA world we call heritage. It is cheaper to build something you already built than to make something new. So MSR right now, you know, would still have some new components. You know, you still need to launch off the surface of Mars, which we've never done before. But a lot of the studies in the re-architecture has shown us opportunities to leverage these heritage components. So maybe using the sky crane delivery technique that we use to deliver Curiosity and Perseverance both to the surface of Mars, using that maybe to deliver the Mars Ascent vehicle and sort of the sample retrieval lander, all of that, so that you can deliver those with precision with something that we know already works. You know, using the sort of the backup arm from Perseverance to take delivery of the samples and put it into the sample receiving lander, putting it into the Ascent vehicle so that it can launch. But, you know, you still need to work out how to launch. There's still orbiter that ESA is contributing to collect the Ascent vehicle with the samples in it and all of that. So there's so many, you know, spinning plates in the air you're trying to balance. But, you know, if you've heard me on the show before, I still argue that Mars sample return is fundamentally one of the most important things we've done. It's sort of our Apollo era of exploration, where we are getting to see something no one's ever seen before, doing things no one's ever done before.
I'm going to ask you about that heritage hardware, but first I'm going to let you know that I'm going to use that in my vocabulary to describe myself. I am no longer getting old. I am heritage hardware.
I love it.
So as you mentioned, Amy, this is so vitally important to scientists like yourself back here on Earth. I'm thinking, by using heritage hardware, does that give you a little more peace of mind, knowing that it is hardware that has been proven to work, that will be used in this very unique and very new mission goal?
So yeah, so you know, if you use something that's flown to Mars and operated successfully, you have a lot of confidence that it's going to be able to do it again. So if we did use Skycrane, that would be the third time we will have sent it to Mars. You know, you can only imagine something that you could never test start to finish on Earth is what we sent Curiosity with, you know. So Skycrane landed Curiosity for the very first time, and you just can't test that end to end on Earth. So it's pretty incredible to see something that was a little bit of a risk, you know, sort of forming one of the foundations for our exploration program. You know we can deliver large payloads with this descent vehicle. One of the taglines from JPL is dare mighty things, right? It took someone saying, you know what, I think we can put a rocket pack on the back of this rover and deliver it to Mars to develop Skycrane in the beginning, right? So it's always a few steps forward in some of our technologies while leveraging other things that really increase the likelihood of success. And so that is the risk posture it looks like they're interested in taking. And it makes me more confident, even more so, that we can get samples back and learn really extraordinary things about Mars and about Earth.
Looking forward to that day. We've been speaking with Amy Williams. She's a member of the Rover's science teams and an astrobiologist at the University of Florida. Amy, always great to chat with you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. You know that Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. And stay connected with this show on social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at AEWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage is online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Allison Castillo. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.